You're listening to WGDR Plainfield, WGDH Hardwick, Goddard College Community Radio at 91.1 FM and 91.7 FM, online at WGDR.org and Facebook. The time now is 6:03. Coming up, we'll have an interview with Jan Rigsby, pathwork teacher from the channelings of Eva Parakis. We'll have the weather at 5:55 with Bob Mintzenberger, Democracy Now! At 8, followed by Tonio with the Magical Mystery Tour at 9 a.m. Keep your dial tuned in to 91.1. Thank you.
And in that way, it is given power, constant power, a power that is not visible or noticeable to you. But it is the undercurrent on which the boat of your life, the vehicle of this incarnation, constantly swings and rocks. It is as though you are carried by that current. And indeed, so you are. But you are no longer connected with the current. You do not know. You create the current through the thoughts that create the words you speak. The unchallenged, unquestioned thoughts you utter within your own mind. So what you need to do where the creation is negative is to constantly challenge your thoughts and say different words. Now, my dearest friend, it is also important for you to understand that the word that is superficially spoken, while underneath the opposite word persists, will of course only create a short circuit. So if you say on a superficial level of your mind, yes, I have all the value, and you do this constantly, you pay lip service to many truths in your mind and in your thoughts, and you say the words, but you do not challenge the words that are opposite. And the only way you can know that opposite words are spoken by you is by the result of your life, which is the absolute proof of what words are spoken within. There can be no mistake about that. So look at what life situation you are unhappy about. Feel the involuntary process that carries you in that pattern, in that manifest, that created that manifestation. And then search within you the word you say that creates. What is specifically the word you say? I tell you, my friends, it will not be so difficult for you to unearth this now. Had you started on your path, you would have been that way. You would have been absolutely convinced your superficial positive words are all there is to it. And you would have been puzzled. Why then are opposite experiences in you? And it cannot be true. There must be an absolute division between your words, your consciousness, your beliefs, your creation, and life that creates these incompatible experiences for you. Now, however, that you have gone deeply enough and you know not only of your lower self, but of your unfortunate hate for yourself and lack of faith in your higher self, in your deserving and your rights to expand and stretch your consciousness into more expansive experience. Now that you know you have them, you will really be able to find the words you still speak in this or that area of your life.
Up here. An on-air live video via telephone with Jan Rigsby this morning. And let me just read your bio here. Early on, Jan decided that having lots of careers would be more fun than just one or even two. She carried her experience as a homemaker into becoming a systems analyst, funding her manufacturing company in 1988. Soon afterwards, she came into consciousness around her spiritual journey, completed her BS in psychology, and trained in massage therapy, cranial sacral polarity, core energetics, somatic experiencing, past life awarenesses, and accessing Akashic records, while also earning her commercial pilot's license. She is a voracious collector of films from all genres and uses them to illustrate and explore pathwork concepts. Jan served for several years as administrator of the Pathwork of California before moving to Australia in 2000 to design and facilitate pathwork transformation programs in Melbourne and Perth. She continues to support workers and graduates as director of the Pathwork of in Australia. It took a long time for me to profoundly understand that spirit can't be known like science, physics, or math. It took even longer to accept that I don't need to control life, only to navigate it. We don't follow the plan of salvation, we are the plan, Jan teaches. That's her paraphrasing of Lecture 159. The conscious mind you express in your daily living is separated from the vast whole, the universal mind, only by an illusory belief that you are separated. You do not possess an aspect of this universal mind. You are not even a separated part of it. You are it. So, good morning, Jan. Are you there?
Thank you.
Hello? We'll be right back, folks, with Jan Rigsby.
Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Sorry about that. Don't know what happened.
I'm not sure either, but it's all good. So I just read your bio.
Yes, heard it. Thank you.
Good. So what is path work for the first question?
Okay. Perhaps I should start by saying that path work as an organization is a bit of a confederacy, meaning that everyone teaches it a bit differently. If you stretch it a little bit, you could take that analogy to Protestantism. That's a big leap. But there are different approaches and different ways of teaching pathwork. So for me, and for the way I teach as a certified pathwork helper, is I teach pathwork as a different perspective, a different way of looking at life. I never was a religious person. I have a little bit of a skeptic in me. So I like to stand off a bit. And pathwork allowed me to see where standing off a bit had great value as long as I didn't isolate.
Okay.
Now, pathwork specifically has to do with a body of material that was channeled. And I'll pause there with channeling, because as you read in my bio, I come from manufacturing. I used to run companies. And channeling was not easy for me to swallow. And early on, one of my teachers said, don't worry about where the material comes from. Just look at whether it's useful to you, and valuable to you. And that's how I approached pathwork. But the material was channeled. And the important thing about that is that Eva Parakas was the channel, but she was not the source of the material, according to her. what she did was she learned through a lot of trial and error to go into a trance state and to deliver oral lectures. And she did this for 24 years, from 1956 to her death in 1979. The material is dense. It is massive. It is very hard to understand. The idea that somebody could just sit down and speak this is impressive. For 24 years, without any mistakes, without any going back, without any inconsistencies, except for difficulties in choosing the right words sometimes. So sometimes the words are used for different concepts, but the intention is not contradictory. So the pathwork lectures form the backbone of the study of what we call pathwork.
And there's 250-something lectures, right?
There are 258 numbered lectures. Mm-hmm. There are about 50, and they'll call them 257A, 257B. What she used to do is she would deliver a talk on a topic, and then in the next fortnight session, she would answer questions about that topic. And so eventually these merged, and then she would answer some questions after the lecture. And then there's a lot of material that was transcribed where Eva would speak as the guide in other circumstances.
Great. And I heard that the first 25 lectures were supposed to be all of the lectures. And then Eva felt like people weren't getting it. So then she went ahead and kept doing 100 and 60 more or something like that. Have you heard that?
I hadn't heard it so much as I experienced it by reading them. Mm-hmm. So with some levity, and I teach with levity, and even the guide says you've got to have some humor about this work. This is not humorless work. In the first 25 lectures, I like to characterize it as the guide, which is, we had to come up with a name for him, so that was the name we gave. The guide laid out what the truth of the universal experience relating to human beings is concerned. And the guide had attracted a group of mystics who loved this material. But just because you know the plan doesn't mean that you're not human and you're not still wrapped up in the illusions that humans are prone to. So the guide around Lecture 25 said, wait a minute. We're going to need to work on this psychology of human beings. And so the guide switched gears and began to work on what kinds of illusions human beings live under, how distortions are manifested and strengthened. And that went on until about lecture 200. And then he kind of switched back into discussions about the unit of state again for the last 50 or 60 lectures.
I hear we're going into a unit of state with the Aquarian Age.
That may be. That may very well be.
I experienced the unit of state recently. And so I was, as an example, I was walking down the street, right? And I saw all these people with these different character traits. But I could see every one of their character traits within me somewhere, and I felt this real connection and compassion to people's struggles, and it was just quite an interesting experience, and I want to try and practice that more often. It seems like Eva was saying that we're all the same, just having different experiences. Would you agree with that?
Instead of saying the same, I would say that we all belong together and we have a capacity to be in the unitive. It's a phrase we use in Baffert.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it does sound like a unitive experience. If people thought like that when they interacted with each other, when they made decisions, when they made plans, the world might unfold a bit differently than it does today.
Yeah. So we have quite a bit of material we can cover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And feel free to take the lead if you'd like.
Okay. You had asked originally, you had sent me a list of things you'd like to cover. One of them was, who is Eva Perakis? And even though she was not the channel, her history does influence Pathwork because she wound up as the community leader as well as the channeler of the material. Now, in contrast, the woman who channeled A Course in Miracles, after she finished channeling that material, handed it over for publishing and walked away from the material. She said, it's not me, and I don't deserve any credit for it. And she wouldn't even let her name be put on the materials when they were published. Eva, on the other hand, was an active participant in the process of studying and understanding this material, and she was a natural leader. She was born Eva Brauch in Austria. Did you play the portion of the lecture before I got on?
I played I Am the Word.
Okay.
Yes.
So your listeners heard that she speaks with a German accent.
Yeah.
And the first 12 lectures were actually delivered in German because she came from Vienna. It's unusual. You want to hear a channel, and the stuff is in English, and she's got this very relatively high-pitched German accent. Seems very human at the time. So she started channeling in 1956 after 5 years of preparation to do this. When people say, what does it take to be a medium? A lot of work and a lot of effort. If you want to channel this transmission clearly and without interfering with the interpretation of it, as it goes through your brain, it becomes human language. Around 1962, she met and married John Parakas. John Parakas had founded Bioenergetics with Alexander Lowen. All that is based on the work of Wilhelm Reich. And John was looking for an added element to bioenergetics. And when he met Eva, he found in core energetics, there's a triangle, and it starts like Maslow with the physical, emotional, mental, the will. And what he was missing was the element of spirit. So when he married Eva, he also married into the pathwork. Mm-hmm. And they led together for the rest of her life. So that's who Eva was. I'm trying to remember, what was the next group that you wanted me to go? You had asked what it takes to be a pathwork helper. When there are formal programs in an area, there is a 4 to 5 year course focusing upon your personal work. And at some point during or after that course, people may decide they would like to teach the work, and that's what happened to me. So I took a 4 year course in California, and around my 3rd year realized that I wanted to teach this work. So the way I tell it is, first you apply the principles to yourself as a personal adventure, and then you figure out how you did that, how your teachers managed to help you do that, mm-hmm. and you learn to do it with and for others. And that takes an additional 4 to 5 years, depending on the person, depending on the training program. Mm. So people often say, I could be a brain surgeon after that. And the truth is that when you are dealing with someone's spiritual belief system, there is an aspect of being a surgeon. But the trick is that you've got to help that person operate on themselves.
Right.
And learn how to stand back. And standing back for me was the hardest part of the whole training.
Yeah, my teacher, I'm in year two of path work, just beginning. And my teacher sometimes says that she gets impatient. Forgive me. we'll have her on sometime, I'm sure, to go into... And she does Brennan healing, too.
So the purpose of the program and the purpose of the personal work is, to some extent, to learn to do what you explained happened to you. Now, it sounds simple once you're able to do it. Okay. So what prevents people from going into a unitive state? And that's where we teach how we have grown up with multiple layers of defenses. Now, we've done that for good reason. Heaven knows you must have defenses. So as we go through life and we get hurt and bruised, we keep applying the equivalent of pieces of armor, pieces of protection. Don't do that again. It hurts. Do this. Mm-hmm. Don't be so vulnerable. Don't be so this. It's very unique and individualized set of defenses. So that when you try to go into a unitive state, there's a knee-jerk reaction to be in your defenses. Oh, if I empathize too much with somebody, I'll give everything away.
Hmm.
Okay. Well, that's not necessarily true, but it's a fear, and the fear will... I love science fiction. And in science fiction, when the Marvel action figure is threatened, sometimes they throw up these iron gates, click, 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 click. And that's what defenses can feel like.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we build up through our lives is a mask, so that people can't see what we really think and really feel, because that gets us in trouble as children. Children are wonderfully transparent and truth-telling and perceptive, and it really upsets the apple cart.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes. So the one thing you teach kids is, say that when your auntie's around, and don't you talk to me like that. And what this does is the child learns to create a buffer between themselves and other people, a place where people can't quite see, where they can pause and reflect. You can call that a mask. You can call it a defense. The words don't quite describe it. It's an energetic feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And the third basic system, in fact, third of four basic systems that we study is images. And that is that we come up with an idea, a conclusion about the world is like this, therefore I must be like that. And we generalize it. We don't leave it in the moment, I must do this with this one person. We generalize it across the board. And with an image, we find that we can interpret life. And our batting average is very good.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing about a batting average is you feel like that's the best you can do. If an image only gets you through 80% of life well, you don't worry about the 20%. 80% is really good.
Mm.
So we grow up, and our images basically become part of who we are. We don't think of them as separate concepts. We learn them as children. They become part of the inherent fabric of our lives.
And they sort of, it sounds like they sort of take over and run the ship.
they begin to operate automatically.
Mm-hmm.
One way of saying it is that these things sink into our unconscious so that we're not fully aware of them. Think of it like driving. Once you learn to drive really well, you don't think about it all the time. It becomes almost instinctive. And if you've learned bad habits, they also become instinctive.
Yeah.
Until you get into an accident and realize you may need to rethink how you drive. And that's how people tend to come into many forms of spiritual work, is they have an accident in life, and they realize something's wrong, and they aren't quite sure what it is. So they begin to go inside. They begin to go deeper,
mm-hmm.
look around for help. Now, the other big concept in pathwork is, there's a lecture on it, it's pathwork 143. It's called Unity and Duality. And what that is about is that on the earth plane, and remember this is a spiritual discipline, on the earth plane we encounter dualities. Hot, cold, hungry, not hungry, alive, dead. And it becomes part of who we are. Something is either hard or soft. And yes, there are gradations, but we immediately classify things into one extreme or the other. It helps tremendously to sort out and triage life,
mm-hmm.
by figuring out what's good and what's bad, what's safe and what's dangerous, what's in and what's out. You know, think of toddlers. They love opposites. It's fun. They really get opposites.
Mm.
The dilemma is that we absorb that as a starting point for life.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the years, we automatically classify things as good, bad, right, wrong, safe, dangerous. When there's a sliding scale, it's a rainbow, it's a bell curve gradation.
Yeah.
But we forget to look at the details very often on some things. So in spirit, there is no duality. Things are hot and cold, in the sense of having the capacity to be either. And they are in one state in the instant, but they'll move through that state and go to another. Where here on Earth, we have to decide, do I pick that up with a mitt, or can I pick it up with my hand? And you need to decide that quite quickly.
Hmm.
That's fine. That's great. That's a wonderful thing to learn. However, when it comes to values, beliefs, understanding other people, we take that same simplistic on-off switch, like the computers, the zeros and ones, and we apply it to whether this person is worthy or unworthy.
Mm.
And we also apply it to ourselves. So this is what I mean when I say that pathwork is a way of perceiving the world differently, fundamentally differently, that we've been taught.
Sounds like a pretty harsh attitude to have either negative or positive, and there's no in-between for judging other people.
Well, as you read in my biography, I find that films are a way to universally communicate a moment, an emotion, a feeling. In the film The Big Chill, one of the characters is being attacked for making an assumption. And he says, "You tell me the last time you have gone through an entire day without making at least one big, juicy assumption."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yes, it's awful, but we deal with so many things on a daily basis that if we had to think through every single decision we made, we wouldn't get a lot done. So all of these thinking mechanisms that humans grow into are very, very useful in the real world for driving, for our profession, for relationships as we go through the day. Where we get in trouble with them is the kind of building an attitude towards life that we are not fully aware of. The phrase unintended consequences comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
So as a systems planner, I learned to think ahead. I learned to think what would happen under these circumstances, what would happen when we're busy, what would happen when we're slow. How does this mechanism, this factory mechanism, work in all situations? But most people don't think like that. They hear an idea, and it either works today or it doesn't work today. If it works today, they'll embrace it without necessarily thinking through whether it would work under the majority of circumstances that they will be dealing with. So same thing about our beliefs. Race is a really good example. Race is slightly instinctive. We notice differences as children. We don't necessarily place a value judgment on them, but we notice.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Then we get feedback from our families, from our cultures, about what these differences may portend, what they represent, what they are communicating to us, and how we should react and how we should act towards people who are different. When we're children, we don't have a developed conscience of our own, and we mimic. We love our parents. We copy our parents in so many ways. We will inevitably copy their attitudes towards other people, situations, and even something as invisible as a belief, we'll sniff it out and pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
We may also rebel against it, but rebellion is not an enlightened state of mind.
Right.
Okay. So then as we grow up, we don't realize how things have gotten inside us. We don't remember the details of how we copied or absorbed or admired, but we can find the remnants. So my parents came from the South, and they were considered rebellious and horribly liberal
mm-hmm.
in the 1930s and 40s.
Yeah.
my father went into the military. It was integrated. He embraced it.
Mm-hmm.
He came back from Korea to New York, and they were billeted overnight. And his bunkmate in Korea couldn't stay in the same hotel with him.
Oh.
And my father, because he was black.
Yeah.
And my father was livid. He was furious. But my father was also not an activist. So while he was angry and upset, he didn't think it was anything he could do anything about.
Hmm.
And yet, with all the my parents brought with them about kindness and goodness and racism is not a bad thing, I have some of it in me. I'm not quite sure where it came from. Perhaps being around relatives, perhaps, I don't know where it came from. Perhaps it was there anyway, and I simply attribute it to Southern roots. The important thing is for me to find it, for me to recognize it, and deactivate it. If you remember Laugh-In and Lily Tomlin's act, she would be sitting there as Ernestine, the telephone operator, mm-hmm. and nowadays it sounds like the Stone Age, but I remember these systems. And you had all the phone wires plugged in, and you had to literally physically connect one line to another.
Mm-hmm.
And she would connect or disconnect depending on whether she liked someone.
Oh.
It was la-di-da. Pull the plug. You've got to learn to pull the plugs in you.
Yeah.
You got to find these connections.
It's like,
and you need to unplug them.
It's like not returning a text message.
Yes. So the dilemma is not that we're imperfect. That's just a human condition. The question is whether we can see where we've gone a bit astray and actively attempt to do something about it, at least not let it manifest, and then even go deeper and look at why is that convenient for me to have let that into me. We talked a bit about spiritual law as a topic, and spiritual law is a really interesting aspect of pathwork. And one of the spiritual laws is of cause and effect. Now, of course, cause and effect.
Just real quick, Jen. Let's tell people who you are and how they can get in contact with you if they'd like.
Hi.
This is Jen Rigsby, and you are a pathwork teacher and helper. It seems like you're a bit higher than just helper. You seem to be more in the teacher category, and you have monthly or weekly lectures that people can join. Is that true?
That is true. Although the software won't hold more than maybe 20 people, we have 10 so far.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I do a lot of teaching, and I have a lot of materials on my website. My website is www.janrigsby.com, JANRIGSBY.com. It has links to all the other sites.
Mm-hmm.
And it is my pleasure to offer teaching materials for people to download at no charge.
Yeah, and I think Pathwork also on pathwork.org .com has free lectures. Every single lecture is free. To download.
So I'm glad you mentioned that. It should have been one of the first things we talked about. www.pathwork.org, and they do offer all 258 numbered lectures for free download.
Right, and audio too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now the audios that they offer are lectures that are read by someone who donated, having read all 258 lectures. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, that's hard to do, to read those lectures with a straight face and get the inflections right.
Yeah.
So they're very helpful for people who prefer to learn via audio, who want to play them in their car.
Yes. Reading them is good, and then listening to them afterwards is even better for me because it's hard to really grasp everything. It's you have to read it over and over and over again, it seems to be. And then if you don't read it for a while and then you pick it back up, it's like reading an entirely new thing sometimes.
Well, there's more to it than that.
Okay.
So I know that we're going to just dance around and touch on various points, but as we hit a juicy one, I'd love to go into it.
Go ahead.
The experience that is universal with the lectures is that you'll read it, you'll get a giant aha, you'll rush out and change your life. A week, a month, a year, 5 years later, you read the same lecture, and you get another aha.
Hmm.
And the joke is, where was that? Who edited this lecture? Who put that in there? I didn't see that the first time. And when asked about it, the guide said that the lectures were designed. And this is what I mean by, for this just to be oral transmission, it's extraordinarily deep material. That the lectures were designed so that you would get what you need, that you would not be overwhelmed. We can't redo our entire lives all at once.
Hmm.
It doesn't leave you in a stable condition to do the things you need to do. So it allows you to get an aha at one level. And then if you wish to go back on that same topic and read it again, it gives you an aha on perhaps a deeper level. So it's not a matter of forgetting the material, but perhaps being more receptive to more aspects of that topic. So my personal experience is I went back to a lecture that I'd studied intensively mm-hmm. for 10 years, and then I left it alone. And we were going to use it for a topic for one of the weekly teleconferences that I use, that I do. And I read it again and had that same experience. Good heavens, where did this come from? Because I was ready for a deeper level on the topic. So congratulations.
And which one was that?
Oh, you name it. It's all over the place. I believe it was...
well, hold on. Let me just read some of the lectures that you've been recently going over. Unity and duality, and then function of the ego, two ways of living away from and towards center, three basic personality types, reason, will, and emotion, the pain of injustice, spiritual law. And I think you were also talking about the compulsion to overcome and recreate childhood hurts.
Let me correct you slightly on that, because I love the title of that lecture. The title of the lecture is The Compulsion to Recreate and Overcome Childhood Hurts. And the reason why, which comes first, is important, is the lecture teaches us, once again, looking at human psychology, that when we grow up with certain dysfunctions in our family, just as well as the good stuff, we don't talk about the good stuff because that's not the problem. The dysfunctions are the problem, so we focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
When we grow up with a certain dysfunction in a family, that dysfunction becomes familiar. It may not be pleasant, but we know it. And we learn to work with it. And we're not as afraid of it sometimes as we are of other dysfunctions. So when we go out looking for a mate or a friend or even a job environment, we may find that we discount the negativity of that dysfunction. You look at it, let's say a friend. You look at a friend, he's got the same habit as your mom. And you think, I know how to handle that. Mm. I handled my mom, I can handle this. And the familiarity is nice. We know how to handle that particular personality trait. Now, the lecture is about how when we have had trouble, I'm going to continue with the same vein in this imaginary scenario, we've had trouble with our mom, but we were never able to get the best of her. We are, to some extent, looking for an opportunity to win that childhood battle.
Yes.
And we'll look at the trait in a person and say, on a level we aren't aware of, I know this, and I never won this game. Mm-hmm. I wonder if I could win this game this time. And so we're actually attracted to the dysfunction, to the old battle. That's the compulsion to recreate. And we're attracted because we want to win this time. We want to resolve this. We want to be strong enough, smart enough, aggressive enough to not be put down, to not be berated, to not feel like a child. We want to be the adult this time.
Mm-hmm. And when?
And so...
And when?
Yes. And, of course, what you're doing is you're living in history. And the way we explain this is that when you are living today as if it was 20, 30 years ago, you're going to get in trouble. Imagine if you were driving a car based on a videotape that was 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Or trying to find your way around a town with the memories of 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay? You're not in the present. You're not really addressing that person as they are. You're projecting onto them your memories and your needs from the person that you mother, father, family system. So that's the problem, is you're living in history. And then when it doesn't work out, very often what you'll do is go find a new opportunity. Mm. So you don't become aware of what you did, you just know it didn't work.
Is this like Euros? Does Euros come into play here with, like, choosing partners?
The pathwork concept of Euros, which is, and by the way, the compulsion lecture is lecture 73. I say that because there's a lot of lectures, and it's hard to find the one you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
The lecture on Euros is brilliant. It's my favorite, one of my favorites, and it's lecture 44. The concept of Euros in pathwork is that Eros is a soul movement. The way I explain it is Eros is like a little puppy that you have on your lap. And the puppy has no morals. It has no shame. It has no compunction not to do what it wants to do. So you walk into a room and you've got this puppy on your lap. And this puppy sees somebody across the room that it thinks is gorgeous. And it leaps off your lap and goes up to that person and jumps all over them and maybe pees in the process. That's Eros.
Yeah.
Your soul is saying, there's something there I want and need. Unfortunately, the human mind must make sense of this. And so the human mind goes through rationalization, justification, a lot of processes that are not soul movements necessarily. They are interpretations based upon what we discussed, defenses, images, childhood battles. And we either drag the puppy back saying, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I apologize. He's not trained. Oh, what can I do? And you shut that down because you're embarrassed about having exposed your instant attraction to this other person, male, female, tall, short, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or you convince yourself that it's true love. Now, a lot of your listeners, especially those with young children, are aware of Frozen. And I didn't like Frozen the first time I saw it, but of course now I've seen it 6 times because my granddaughter is wild about it.
Oh, the movie Frozen?
Yes, movie Frozen.
Okay.
And truth is, it's a pretty good movie. And what I realized is it teaches a really important lesson. Don't get engaged on the first day you meet someone. That sounds like a stupid thing to teach. Children need to hear that. They need to hear that there's no rush. They need to hear to take their time. Okay. But as adults, we can become so desperate for love that we think we must grab it instantly. And we don't think it through. And once we make a commitment or two, we're too embarrassed to back out.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to look like someone who changes their mind or breaks their promises. And so we wind up going into relationships based upon an original impulse, which may have been about learning something, not about marrying someone. So I had a client. I have had many clients, but some clients give me brilliant stories. I had a client that I worked with for years, and you dig and dig and dig, and you're looking for the germ of where life went wrong for her. And she explained one day that she was about to get married, and his family lived across the country,
mm-hmm.
and they had already bought their plane tickets for the wedding, and it was 2 or 3 days away, and she realized she didn't want to marry him. But she felt an obligation to these relatives who had bought their plane tickets. And so she married the man rather than expose her change of mind and inconvenience other people. Needless to say, the marriage did not work out.
Sounds like my first wedding.
So this is where Eros can tell us the truth. But it can also only give us a piece of the puzzle. And it's our job to figure out what that impulse is about.
And I guess let's go into what is the solution for this after the weather report.
Okay.
And this is Jan Rigsby, an pathwork teacher from Eva Parakis, is channeled lectures. And Jan, why don't you call back at around 7 a.m., okay?
No worries, I'll do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Erickson.
All right. Bye-bye.